We are in Mark chapter 4 today. If you haven't been with us, we are in a series we're calling Dust, and we're calling it Dust because what we're doing is following Jesus. And Jesus was a rabbi, a Jewish teacher, that's what they called him. And there's a phrase, a saying in the Jewish tradition that you always want the dust of your rabbi to be on your feet. And what that means is if you follow a rabbi, you're a disciple. And it was a blessing to be so close to your rabbi all the time that when he walked and kicked up dust, it landed on you. That was seen as a blessing. And so as we go through the life of Jesus, and it's going to take us till Easter, what we want to do is get closer and closer to Jesus as our teacher, as our Lord, as our rabbi. And we've dealt with a lot of different things so far. Last week, Paul and Pete taught on Jesus's healings. This week, we're on Jesus's miracles. And you might look at me and say, Charlie, I didn't go to Bible college or get a seminary degree, but those are the same things, buddy, right? Yes and no. So how we're differentiating it is, look, all of Jesus's healings are miracles, without a doubt. But not all of the miracles of Jesus are healings. So all of his healings are miracles, but not all miracles are healings. Today we're dealing with a miracle where Jesus kind of controls some water, right? And why that matters is because it changes fundamentally what we learn and how we see the character of Jesus. And in our text today, one of the tensions that I love is kind of this tension of, so often when things are really familiar, we forget what they are, you know? That's why Valentine's Day existed last week. Because you get married and you live with them every single day and you get in this rhythm and they become incredibly, your spouse becomes incredibly familiar and you forget that at one point there was this passion, you know? And on one day we buy all the chocolates in the land and give them all the flowers that Kroger sells and we say, remember when we had passion, you know? It's fantastic. There's a story that I loved. I read it last fall in September. There's a guy from the UK, and he went to Las Vegas for a bachelor party. So, you know, awesome start to a story. And he and his buddies went to the Hoover Dam. And if you've ever been to the Hoover Dam, you have two levels. You have the one level that's higher where the Colorado River comes in, and then it sucks in the water and shoots it out below. So this guy's from the UK, and he said, and in almost a direct quote, I had been up and drinking for 36 hours, and we get to the Hoover Dam again. The story gets better. And so he's from the UK. It's 100 plus degrees in Nevada when he went there. And so for him, that's boiling point. So he sees the Colorado side of the Hoover Dam and says, oh, that looks awesome. Let's jump in for a swim. He says, I'm going to swim from this side to that side of the Hoover Dam. And he does. I'm sure he was sober at that point. And so he dives in and he starts swimming across and he actually makes it to the other side. And okay, at this point, you have all the cops there and they find him and they pull him out of the water. And one of the officials looks at him and said, I cannot believe that you made it. His exact words were, I have never seen anybody do what you just did. And the drunk UK guy said, why? And he said, because about in the last 10 years, about 200 plus people have tried to do that and they've all died, except for you. You're the first person. What this guy didn't know, it seemed like the water was just like bath time or pond water on top, right? But the Hoover Dam has 10 turbines that constantly suck water down into it. 9 of them were shut off that day. The guy said, if one more had been turned on, you would have died. The British guy even said, yeah, I felt the strong pull. I just swam harder. Right? I know. He's kind of my hero. Anyway, so he swims across to the other side. And I love that story because I think in some way it gives us this tension between we see water all the time and we forget that it's really powerful. I think when we're familiar with things, when we see it in the day-to-day, we sometimes forget what they really are. I think with faith and with Jesus, we get up in the morning and read a devotional, and we go to church on Sundays and maybe even 2 times a week if you really love Jesus, right? And you serve and you teach your kids and it becomes really familiar and it becomes overly familiar. And in that, what happens is we're so close to it all the time that sometimes we might be numb to who Jesus actually is. And that's what happens with the disciples. Mark chapter 4, let's read some text. I'm going to read the whole story. It's pretty short. It's 6 verses. And then I will come back and we'll break it up and teach through it. Mark chapter 4, verse 35, all the way through to 41. It goes like this. On that day, when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, let's go across to the other side of the lake. So after leaving the crowd, they took him along, just as he was, in the boat. and other boats were with them. Now a great windstorm developed, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was nearly swamped. But he was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. They woke him up and said to Jesus, "Teacher, don't you care that we're all about to die?" So he got up. He rebuked the wind and the sea and said, "Be quiet, calm down." Then the wind stopped and it was dead calm. And he said to his disciples, "Why are you cowardly? Do you not have faith?" They were overwhelmed by fear and said to one another, "Who is this then that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So our story picks up in Mark 4, and it's in between two other stories. In Mark 4, verse 1, what we see is Jesus teaching. He gets in a boat, and they taught in boats because they'd brush off a little from the shore, and you'd use the water as an amplification system, and you'd speak, and the water would amplify your voice to the crowds, and they'd all gather around. And it started in the morning. And he taught parable after parable after parable, and it says, when evening came, he said, "Let's go to the other side." They were going to the other side. It picks up in chapter 5, and Jesus started healing some people, you know? So what we have literally in our text is a period of transition. He says, from this side, we're going to go to the other side. We find transition. And it's kind of a side note point, but it's one that I love. I think so often when we go in and out of life, I think so often that when we don't expect it, storms, trials, whatever word you want to substitute there to mean life isn't what we thought it was going to be, it happens in the middle of transitions. I speak for a living and I help others sometimes speak for a living, and I've done some work with other churches and other speakers and staff members in other churches. And the one thing I'll say at the very beginning is you're gonna make or break your sermon, your talk, your lecture, whatever in your transitions. You make or break it. That's when you lose it. Because you know your first point and it's thought out well, and you know your second point and it's thought out and thought out well, but that transition, sometimes you let your guard down and you're tired and you're vulnerable, and that's when you're gonna make or break it. When people are gonna look at you and say, "I got it," or "What was that man talking about when he was yelling at me for 35 minutes, you know? And so I love this text because they're in the middle of a transition, literally going from point A to point B, and they're focusing on what point A was and what point B will be, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, when they're tired, when they're vulnerable, a storm pops up. And that happens, you know? And so in verse 36, after leaving the crowd, they took him along just as he was in the boat, and the other boats were with him. 37, now a great windstorm developed, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was nearly swamped. So there's three, in the Greek text, there's three times in our passage where it's gonna describe mega something. And we're gonna walk through those. The first one is, it says there was a great windstorm. Literally the word in the Greek is there was a mega storm, right? A very, very big storm. And it says the storm was so big that the waves were overtaking the boat. To understand what's happening, you kinda gotta get what the Sea of Galilee is, which is what they're crossing. The Sea of Galilee was about 700 feet below sea level. It was surrounded on most of the sides by mountains. And so it was known for great storms to pop up out of nowhere. It's what we call Texas, right? You go from everything's great to, oh my gosh, hide the kids, you know? Really, really quickly. And that's what happens. They're on the lake in the middle of the evening, towards nighttime, traveling to get there by morning. And all of a sudden, the storm pops up out of nowhere. I don't know if you guys have ever been caught in the middle of a storm. I remember the first time that I remember being scared of a storm. I was playing baseball, and it was in the area. I was 5, 6, 8, I don't know, somewhere there, small. And playing baseball, and it was fine. And then all of a sudden, in a span of about 5 minutes, the temperature dropped about 25 degrees. And the sky goes from bluish to angry. You know, and I remember being there on the baseball field, and it was some kind of playoff select baseball game, and I look up, and you could literally see the funnel form of the clouds, no kidding. And parents are screaming and yelling, and the wind's picking up, and they're like, "Everybody get in the cars!" And my mom's yelling at me, and I'm just staring straight up in the air like, "Mom, this looks kind of cool. I've seen Twister. I know what happens. We make it, right?" And I remember thinking, "Oh, this is amazing. I'm captivated by this." And what scared me wasn't that, because I was young. What scared me was I get to the parking lot, and at this point, the wind was so bad, it actually was moving parked cars. And I was like, "Wait a second. This thing can do more push-ups than me. You know, this thing is stronger than I am." And I was absolutely terrified. I don't know if you got caught in the hailstorm last year in April, the one that tried to bring the church down. If you're a deacon, you laugh. We we got dumped on with huge hails, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was driving in this area as it happened, and it starts and you're fine. Have you guys ever been in a car when hail starts? Have you been in a car when pea-sized hail starts? Let's up that to softball-sized hail. It feels like you're in an underground bunker in London in World War II and you're getting bombed by the Germans, right? I mean, you are terrified. And why that matters is because I don't think I've ever felt more vulnerable or afraid or I can't control anything when you're in the middle of a storm. And you're like, well, this is gonna go how it goes. And I'm really hoping it breaks in my favor. The point here is they're in the middle of a storm and we know it's pretty bad. And I'm betting you, because I've been in storms before, that they are not just scared. They think they are about to die. It was this mega storm. And it's in the middle of the sea. I don't know if you've been ever afraid by water, but water's scary and sometimes we forget, you know? At this point, there was at least four professional fishermen on this boat. And the boats they had there were 7 feet wide by 27 and a half feet long by 3.5 feet deep, give or take. So these guys are professional fishermen and they are absolutely terrified by the water. They said they're taking on too much water when it says in verse 37, that the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was nearly swamped. What that literally means is that it's taking on more water than it can handle, and it's sinking, you know? Remember the first time I was ever afraid of water was my best friend at the time when I was eighth grade. His parents sold a business they owned for about $15 million and said, what should we do with this money? Let's sell our house in Double Oak, and let's move to the Virgin Islands, build a house that looked over a cliff. I'll be a baseball coach, the wife was a nurse, and they lived happily ever after, right? So I remember thinking, good for that guy. And I grew up around pools, because this is Texas. And I was a good swimmer. I took all the YMCA classes. I was advanced, probably not because I was good. I was very undersized. I was negative weight. I was buoyant. So I remember thinking, I got this. We went to visit him at one point. I was in the eighth grade, and they rented a boat. We did some spear fishing, which really was just me looking at the fish and trying to figure out how to shoot them, and I never was successful. And I remember at one point, I surface, and the boat's probably 50 feet that way. And I was like, oh, that's farther than where it began. I should swim back. And this is in the Caribbean somewhere, so I'm swimming back to the boat, and, you know, I do my little thing. I get a little tired. I look up. I was like, I got to almost be there. I stop swimming. The boat is farther away than where it began. Right? I'm swimming and nothing's happening. I'm realizing it the very first time, okay, water's bigger than me too, you know? So these guys were professional fishermen and they're terrified. They're terrified. Because water in that context, in that time, in that place signified death. Because they couldn't control it. They didn't have a 14-day forecast they could look at. They just knew that they couldn't control the power of water. They didn't know what it was gonna do. And so it's symbolizing their culture, death. That's why when we baptize people, you go down into the water, dead yourself, come up with new life. It's the idea that they don't understand water and it's scary and nothing can control it. Not to mention, it's nighttime. Have you ever swam in dark water? Dark water is scary, guys. I don't care if you're in your hot tub at home. If I can't see what's happening beneath me, I'm a little petrified. This is the Sea of Galilee. So they're terrified. One, it's a huge storm. Two, the boat is taking on water and it's probably about to sink at some point. And three, if the professional fishermen are scared, how scared do you think the other guys are? There's four spots on this boat they were in that you can probably use to paddle. And I can imagine those might be the professionals and they're going as the storm gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's kind of like when you have a kid and they fall over. You have about a 3-second window to convince your kid it's not a big deal, you know? When they look at you like, should I cry? And they start, and you're like, it's okay. And they're like, oh, it's good. I just needed somebody to tell me that. Imagine you're in that moment and you look at the leaders of this thing on the water and they're terrified. Everybody's freaking out. They thought they were gonna die. And in the moment when they thought they were gonna die, they look over at Jesus. Look at verse 38. Because Jesus had done cool things. And they say, but Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. Okay. So if you think you're gonna die, and you look at the guy that brought you there, you look at the guy that you think is leading you, and you know you're about to die, and he's sleeping, I don't know what you feel, but it's probably not comforted, you know? And let's take a second and talk about the fact that Jesus was sleeping through this storm. One, we downplay the omnipotence, the powerfulness of God. That dude can sleep through anything. My wife is Christ-like, by the way, right? I am convinced. Two, I think it does a couple things here, right, when you read the text. One is he taught all day long. Dude was wiped out. I'm going to teach twice today and do a Q&A, and I'm going to be tired. And so he taught for probably 7, 8, 9 hours. And so he's sleeping because he's human and he gets tired. And two, and some people do this, I don't know if I would, but you know, they say his sleeping on the outside reflected his inner spiritual peace. Maybe. Look, I don't know if that's the case or not. We don't know. You can go there if you want to and impress your friends in small group. But what we know is that really he's just tired, he's wiped out, and he's sleeping. And the disciples look over and they cannot understand why the person they trusted is asleep when they thought they were gonna die. They felt alone. They felt forgotten. They felt betrayed. And I get it. One commentator, he wrote one on the book of Mark, he said, it was a cry of distrust, but one often matched by believers today because in difficult circumstances, when they feel that the Lord has forsaken them. So when they go to Jesus and they said, teacher, don't you care? It wasn't, do you think we're gonna die? It's, hey, what would you do in this situation? They wake Jesus up and they say, we're about to die and you don't care about us. Oh, they rebuke Jesus. They felt betrayed. I get it. I've felt alone before when I've gone through stuff. And you look at God and you say, where are you? It feels like you're sleeping, you know? And so they rebuke Jesus, and I think their tone shows us a couple things. So one, they start with teacher. They don't clearly understand who Jesus is. Two, when they rebuke Jesus, it shows us what they think of him a little bit. Because if they thought of Jesus as like Lord of everything, I don't think they'd be like, hey man, why are we gonna die? I think they'd come at him with a little more trust. But the tone with which they approached him showed how they saw him, right? So for example, when I got hired here 9 years ago, 9 and a half-ish something years ago, I was the middle school pastor. And, okay, the story's a little awkward for me, but stick with me, all right? So there were this group of girls that went to Downing, and they were, I think, 7th graders, maybe 8th graders. And my name is Charlie, if you didn't know. So they thought it'd be fun to make Charlie's Angels t-shirts for themselves to wear. I used to go to middle school lunches, right? And so I did not know this was going on. That's a whole different kind of creepy. If I was like, what if we did this, girls? That did not happen, all right? So my next door neighbor at the time, I lived by Marcus, his mom was the check-in person, the receptionist at Downing. And I didn't know this, but I show up to go to lunch at Downing one day and these 3 girls had Charlie's Angel shirts on. It looks really weird, I will give them that, right? That the new youth pastor of the area shows up, these girls make shirts with his name on it, and he comes to lunch. It looks like, I'm like, guys, this would be great if I had a fan club of 13-year-olds, right? So I'm talking to this guy outside of our house, is literally my next door neighbor. And I'd just been to this lunch, and I was like, hey, what if we don't wear these shirts again? Just for me, right? They actually made one for me, and I did not wear it. So I'm talking to this guy, and he's the son of the mother that runs the reception desk at Downing. And man, he didn't know what I did for a living, and he starts going off. He's just saying, can you believe these youth pastors these days? And I'm like, no. And he says, my mom works at Downing, and this youth pastor made these girls make shirts for the lunch that he showed up at. And I was like, that guy sounds terrible. Right? I mean, I'm not saying it's me yet, right? So he starts blasting away and talking to me about me, but he didn't know that I was the guy. And I think like 2 weeks later, I was like, hey, I got to tell you something. I was like, that guy that you're talking about? Man, that's me, right? And he goes, oh. I said, I didn't know that they were gonna make those shirts. We have since hid and or burned them. I have no idea, I am so sorry. They were just middle school girls being middle school girls, you know? And he said, oh yeah, I didn't know it was you. And that changed his perspective on how he talked to me because he knew who I was. The tone with which we talk to people reveals what we think of them, right? So when the disciples rebuke Jesus for not saving, I don't think they're getting a bigger picture of who Jesus is. And so what Jesus does after that, let's look in verse 39. He got up, he rebuked the wind, and he said to the sea, be quiet, calm down. The wind stopped, and it was dead calm. First of all, literally what's implied in the text here is he spoke to it like you speak to a child. He looked at the wind and the sea, and he said, stop it, like you do if your kid's punching their brother in the back seat of a car. I will turn this boat around, right? He said, stop it. It's in the aorist tense in the Greek, which is the past tense, which literally means that when it went calm, it was like it'd been calm all the time before. You know when you do a cannonball into a pool and you're not doing any more cannonballs, but there's still the ripple effect of the water? It said that immediately it went calm, like there'd never been any waves, like it had already been calm before. Our second mega in our text is here. It was literally, it went mega calm, right? And I think this is one of the things I love, the nuances in the text of miracles is, I love when things like this happen. There's a story in the Old Testament where God parts a sea, the Red Sea, as Israel's fleeing from Egypt. And we've all kind of probably walked on ponds that have lost some water, or we've been in swampy messes or all that kind of stuff. And you can imagine if there's a literal sea that God parts, if Israel's walking through with 5 million people, it's probably a little muddy. But it says in the text that they walked through on dry ground. I love that just because I think the details of the miraculous show the absolute majesty of a God who does it. He doesn't do it halfway, right? He doesn't split the sea and says, it's gonna be muddy, put on some galoshes. He doesn't say, it's not a little ripply, but you get the idea, right? It's calmer, it's not relative. He says, it was completely all the way 100% calm. And I think it shows the majesty of Jesus. He rebukes it like a child, and it's done. And then he turns his attention to his disciples. Verse 40. And he said to them, why are you cowardly? Do you still not have faith? The word there, literally cowardly or timid, is what it means. Kind of weak is a good interpretation of the word there. It's going to be translated a couple different ways. And this section is interesting because it's pretty clear that Jesus is disappointed with his disciples. And it's pretty clear that he was hoping they'd be somewhere where they weren't. Because we have to understand, the disciples are 12 dudes that knew Jesus before he made all these claims, that knew Jesus probably before, at least a few of them did, because their family, before he started healing people, that watched him grow up a little bit and that knew his parents, that knew where he lived. We read the text and we assume all along what we know now, which is he was God. They didn't know that. And so they are progressing in their understanding of who he is. And at this point, he's healed a lot of people and he's said a lot of great things and he teaches with authority. And they thought, great, this rabbi is amazing for a rabbi, like borderline prophet. Like, I love this guy. And Jesus looks at his disciples and says, I can't believe you were scared. I thought you'd be farther along than this. He says, your faith is cowardly. And here's what I want to get across, is that Jesus is disappointed in the faith and the maturity and the maturation of the faith of the disciples, but just because he's disappointed doesn't mean he doesn't love them. Just because he's disappointed doesn't mean that their identity's changed. I can give you 20 or 30 or 40 examples of times when I disappointed my parents, especially in the 4 years of high school. I was pretty good at it. Thought about going pro. And over and over and over again, when my parents would look at me, my mom, and say, hey, I'm just a little disappointed. I was still their kid. They still loved me, they were for me. And because they were disappointed, it showed me that they wanted something more for me. It doesn't mean it changed how they saw me. So when Jesus looks at his disciples and says, guys, I thought we'd be farther along than this, it's a beautiful statement of his dreams and hopes for them. It's a beautiful statement that Jesus says, I want your faith to grow, not stay stagnant. It's a beautiful statement of what he wants for them. Because we have to reconcile this idea that sometimes Jesus can be disappointed in his followers, and that's okay. And you can either look at it as a shame-based thing, which I don't. I look at it as saying God wants more for us because we're already in the family, you know? And that is a grace-based way to look at disappointment, like, oh, it should push us forward because it doesn't change who we are, doesn't change how much we're valued, doesn't change how much God loves us. All that it changes is it shows us that God wants more for us. It's a loved-based motivator that says keep going. There's more that you haven't hit yet, and it's better. So Jesus looks at his disciples and says, why? Why aren't we farther along? When Jesus stilled the storm, I think he was doing a couple things. One of them is I think it moves his disciples from a place of he's a great teacher to when you control water, that's only something God could do. In Psalm 89, it says in verse 89, O Lord, sovereign God, who is strong like you, O Lord? Your faithfulness surrounds you. You rule over the proud sea. When its waves surge, you calm them. It's a commentator named France, and he said, control of the elements is even more extraordinary and inexplicable than the restoration of suffering human beings. And it is in the OT a frequently noted attribute of God, in distinction from human beings who find themselves helpless before the forces of nature. I think in every single way, what Jesus is doing in this text for his disciples when he calms the seas is announcing his deity. He's saying, this is something only God can do. Watch. And so if you're a disciple, if you thought you were gonna die, and then Jesus stands up and says something, and it stops, and then he looks at you and says, guys, why is your faith weak? There's only really one response in this moment, and it's verse 41, which he says, they were overwhelmed by fear and said to one another, who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? There's our third mega that's overwhelmed by fear, literally is megon phobon. So it's they had great mega fear. Phobos is the Greek word for fear. It's where we get phobia from. And so it says that Jesus did this, and their only response was, they weren't just afraid. They weren't just like, oh, that's kind of, you know. He said, they were incredibly afraid. They were more afraid of the guy in the boat with them than they were of the storm. It's this really great transfer of their idea of who Jesus is. So in the scripture, there's a couple different kinds of fear that we see. So it kind of goes with maturity too. We see fear based on just overpoweringness. So like they can be afraid of other armies because the armies could smite them, kind of sort of fear. Israel was afraid of Egypt in the Old Testament. There's a fear that's born out of respect, like I respect my parents kind of sort of fear. And then there's a third fear that we see throughout the scriptures, and this is kind of a fear that's different than the others. It's what we're gonna call like reverence and wonderment. A good word for it is quite simply awe. Max Lucado said, fear at its center is perceived loss of control. And so when we talk about what we're afraid of it because it's bigger than us. And in the boat, what's happening literally is disciples for the first time are seeing the bigness of Jesus in a way they hadn't before. They are filled with awe. For our purposes, we're going to define awe as a reverential respect mixed with fear and wonder. For the first time, the disciples look at Jesus who calms the storm, and they are in awe of who he is. It's this idea that for the first time you see the bigness of what you're dealing with, this mega fear. I was reading a couple psychology blogs this week just on the idea of awe, and one of them said, awe creates a shift in attention towards larger entities and diminishment of the individual self. What that means is you're in awe of God when you're not in awe of the stuff around you, you know? And for the first time, I think the disciples look around and they see Jesus in a different way. And here's the deal. That's why I love this story. That's why we're teaching it this morning. Is I think we are a low formal culture. I think we come to church in flip-flops and shorts and hats. And I think that's fantastic, by the way. I'm in no way saying let's suit up every Sunday, okay? I think that we teach lessons about Jesus like he is my friend and God is my daddy. And those are great too, because those are true. Every word of that is true. But I think because our faith is so familiar, because that's the lesson we teach over and over and over again, sometimes with the familiarity of Jesus as our friend and the low formality of our culture, we forget that Jesus is also the one who stills the storm. That we also need to be in awe of Jesus. Because at the end of the day, what happens is the way we see Jesus ultimately changes the way we follow him. So if we see Jesus as just a great teacher, then when a storm comes, we're freaked out. If we become too familiar with the rhythms of how we put Jesus in our boxes and we forget that he breaks those boxes, we don't understand that he's also God and Lord. And what this passage did, what this story did, what it did in the lives of the disciples is in every single way it took them from believing that Jesus was a teacher and maybe a prophet to absolutely God. It changed the way they followed him. So the question we come to today is quite simply, what do you think about Jesus? And how is that informing how you're following him? Is he a good teacher? Does he bring morality to your children? Does he tell them to obey? Those are good, right? Does he make your marriage better? Awesome. I'd say we cannot forget in a culture of familiarity that God also inspires awe. And sometimes it's easy to forget. And so I think a challenge that we have in our culture and how we gather is, where are we in awe of God right now? Where is God showing us that he's the guy in the boat that says, I'm controlling all of this? I think of a couple different ways as we close. I think one is, just let's go church world stuff. I think of, lately in Crossroads, there's been a lot of transition and turnover and in good ways. I think of Sammy Davenport, you know? So if you don't know the story, Sammy, we joke and we call his church Crossroads South because he took Bill Rector from us too. And they're meeting every week and they were meeting in a barbecue place and that got shut down. And Sammy left Crossroads, he was a worship guy, and just leapt and started a church at 60-something. That's scary. And so we started that church and it was going pretty well. They got kicked out of the barbecue place, walked back into a place they met at before that wasn't as great. And then back in the 70s or whenever Sammy was young, back in the 70s, Sammy started working at a church in Dallas, and it's his first one. That church sold a bunch of stuff years ago, and they're still there, but they're very small. They've been dying. They approached Sammy and said, hey, what if you come and take us over? So no kidding, long story short, Sammy's at the church that he started at 40 years later with no debt at a church that's growing and thriving, right? He didn't see that 2 years ago when he left here. I'm in awe of God. I'm in awe of God that I moved in with Andy 3 years ago, and we said, what would it look like if we did church together, and he's on staff here now. I'm in awe of God. I'm in awe of God that I took this job 9 years ago and I never thought I'd still be here. I love you people, but I didn't think I'd still be here. I'm in awe of God. I'm in awe of God every time I sit down or stand up and worship with you. I'm in awe of God. I think this story reminds us that we need to be in awe of Jesus. And I want to ask the question, where is that for you? As we wrap today, there's a story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it's about some kids that find a secret world in a wardrobe, and they're walking around, and so when you find a secret world in a wardrobe, what do? You talk to beavers. So they did. And in the book, it's these adventures of these four children in this magical kingdom of Narnia, right? It's a fun story, but it's also an allegory of Christ and salvation. That's why it was written. And Christ is represented by this lion, Aslan. And so when they're in Narnia, the children meet Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who describe the mighty lion to him, and their interchange goes like this. The beaver said, he's the king, he's the lord of the whole world, but he's not often here, you understand. Never in my time or my father's time, but the word has reached us that he's come back. He's in Narnia at this moment. Is he mean? Asked Lucy. Is he a man? Asked Lucy. Aslan a man? Said Mr. Beaver sternly. Certainly not. I tell you, he's the king of the world and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who's the king of the beasts? Aslan is a lion, the lion, the great lion. Oh, said Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I will feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, dearie, and no mistake, said Miss Beaver. If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly. Then he isn't safe, asked Lucy. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Miss Beaver tells you? Who said anything about being safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you, and he's good. I wonder where the moments of awe are in our relationship of Jesus, because the way we see him determines how we follow. Let me pray and let's worship. God, I'm thankful for who you are, that you are bigger than the storm, that you are God and that you are a friend, that you are teacher and that you are savior. I'm thankful for the bigness of a God who blows up our boxes. I'm thankful that you came to save. My prayer right now, my charge this week is that you show us again in awe of who you are. It could be in small ways when we talk with our family or see our kids, or in big ways like when you do things that we can't control. I just pray that you instill in us a rich, deep sense of awe for who you are as the Lord. So as we worship, may we worship that God who inspires reverence and fear and instills awe. I pray these things in his name. Amen.